Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke, the producer of The Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, WAMC's president and CEO and political observer Alan Chartok and Roundtable host Joe Donahue are joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature your favorite panelists discussing the most important issues of the week. On Monday, March 15th, Alan and Joe spoke with UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies Jennifer Burns, political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post, and Albany Law School professor and director of the Immigration Law Clinic, Sarah Rogerson. This section begins with an email sent in during the broadcast by a WAMC listener.
We go to Donna, who says, under what legal basis would Cuomo temporarily turn the governor's position over to Hochul? Does the New York State Constitution provide for situations like this? Wouldn't he have to actually leave office for her to be appointed? Who knows the New York State Constitution? Anyone?
Yeah. Well, actually, my colleague Bennett Liebman at Albany Law School does, and he had a Twitter thread this weekend that I believe sums up perhaps a white paper that he's written on the subject or research he's done in the past. I meant to locate any publications that he's put out there. If they have been, they'd be on the Government Law Center website at Albany Law. There does not seem to be a provision in the Constitution that has ever been enacted, proposed, but not enacted, that would provide a mechanism for removal from office.
Say, what happens if the governor, any governor, and then there's a lieutenant governor, what happens if the governor has a stroke and is incapacitated? One would think that the lieutenant governor would take over the day-to-day operations.
From what I gleaned, there was a provision that was proposed about incapacitation, and it was stricken. And I think because they couldn't agree on what would constitute incapacitation.
I kind of get that now.
Probably they're all in the room and said, yeah, what could happen? Yeah, like what, you know, it's not like he's going to ... We'll go to Kathleen, who says, why would the legislature not impeach him? He is utterly toxic at this point. Right.
You know what's really interesting, though, about this is that women elected officials are far less likely to be accused. And I think it's far greater that people who are likely to commit these types of offenses should be chilled from running for office. And those who would never do such things in the workplace will be empowered to run for office because they can start climbing the ladder that puts them in a position to assume the governorship without fear of being harassed in the workplace, right? I am far less concerned about men who behave inappropriately being chilled from running for office than I am that women, young women in particular, think about girls in New York State right now who are looking and saying, why haven't we had a woman governor in this state yet?
So what are you proposing?
I am proposing that we stop focusing on the perpetrators and think more about women and girls in the state, how we support them, how we develop them, and how we empower them.
Well, that's great. But I thought, okay, I'm just not sure. I'm not trying to be clever here because I'm not. but I'm just asking you what it is, whether what you're recommending is a preventative measure about men running for political office. Sounded that way.
No, I'm not. That would be ludicrous. What I'm saying is if we're worried about chilling effects of investigations and accusations and attention paid to this, the chilling effect that I'm more concerned about is the chilling effect on women and girls who see this and say, I don't want to be involved in government.
I got it.
Let's go to the Mexican border. The headline in today's New York Times on Mexico's border with U.S. desperation as migrant traffic piles up. Mexico is struggling to deal with a new wave of migrants expelled from the U.S., while even more come north hoping to cross. Shelters that were empty 4 months ago are now having to turn many away. Sarah, this is your work. So give us a sense of the situation and what we know. I will say in this article in the New York Times, the United States is expelling them back to Mexico, where they wait along with tens of thousands of others hoping to cross. The pressure and desperation is quickly building among families stuck in Mexico as shelters and officials struggle to help them. Meanwhile, federal authorities are scrambling to manage a sharp increase in children who are crossing the border on their own and then being held in detention facilities. So what needs to be done immediately and what needs to be done over the long term?
And if you were Biden, what would you be thinking right now?
I speak from expertise in immigration policy, which Joe Biden is not. He has a lot of really great people working for him, but he's in a different position, right? So like in the political position, politics screws everything up. You've got Republicans coming out and saying, you know, now that Biden's president, and because he's opening our borders, now we have a rush of people at the border, which is just not true. It's the same old thing they say every single time. I mean, my first time speaking to local news outlets on this subject was in 2000, I want to say 13. And every year, there's migration patterns are predictable. There are push-pull factors. It gets politicized because it's a federal issue. What I would do in the short term is what all immigration, what many, most immigration experts agree on, especially immigration experts who have studied the laws involving detention of children, which is bring them in. Do not, I am, there is no political line that says we're opposed to sheltering children who are fleeing forced gang membership, human trafficking, you know, starvation. And like, these are kids, and they come when they believe that they can live a better life, when their parents send them, separate from them in order to give their children a chance at a life, period, not just a better life, but a life, period.
So Sarah,
and we miss all of that in this noise about rushes and panic and whatever. Just let them in.
So are you saying that every child who wants to come in should come in?
Every child who is presenting as an unaccompanied child should be processed through the border and in a child-centered way, placed with appropriate caregivers. That's the way it's supposed to work. Under the Obama administration, families presenting at the border will be provided with a caseworker. And under this program, the vast majority, over 90%, I think it was over 92%, of individuals who were then brought before an immigration judge to plead their case showed up to court because they had appropriate supports. We've got a bill pending in New York State that would provide mandatory attorneys, counsel, to immigrants who are facing removal proceedings. That's the fancy term for going to immigration court. And we know that people who show up with lawyers, not only are they more likely to avail themselves of the court process, they're more likely to win their case. So, you know, we've got a lot of bona fide claims of people who have not been allowed in this country. We shut down our borders in a historically unprecedented move based on false science and against the recommendations of other federal bureaus. And that was Mike Pence who did that. It's just, I wish everybody could be an immigration expert. I wish everybody could go to the border and see what really happens. I wish everybody could, and everybody does, whether you know it or not, you're talking to immigrants every day of your life, right. Especially in New York State. Immigrants power this country, and I really get frustrated with the media and even reputable news outlets who do great job reporting on immigration. But I'm representing our clinic is representing people who were stuck in the migrant protection protocol and who were recently permitted to come into the United States. And these are people with real asylum claims based on international and domestic law who have been sitting in refugee camps created by our federal government for over a year.
So
that created a humanitarian crisis.
So I realize that, I mean, you addressed this, but I just want to clarify, as it stands right now, are there things that this administration is currently doing that are wrong, that should be changed immediately, that could help this situation of what we're seeing?
Well, it looks like they're working on it. So as of last night, I saw that some kids had been held for 5 days in temporary facilities, and it's supposed to be no more than 72 hours. There's an agreement called the Flores Settlement Agreement that sets forth the conditions under which our government can detain children and what's supposed to happen. We have all these laws in place through the Office for Refugee Resettlement specific to unaccompanied minors that places them in more child-centered facilities. That's the system we have. We can do better, and we should do better. And not only are we stuck with the system we have, but we're stuck a little bit with the system that we have that Trump and Stephen Miller made more punishing and more inhumane. And the Biden administration has done a lot of things. They've emptied, they've cleared out the detention, some of the worst detention facilities, and have released families who have been in family detention. There are signs and signals that family detention may be at an end, which is great. Getting away from private detention facilities, all these good moves. It's just they can't move fast enough
right.
to undo the gravity of damage that was done under the Trump administration. It cannot be overstated how terrible that was.
So this morning, as we read headlines that the Biden administration is directing FEMA to help shelter migrant children, is that how much of a Band-Aid is that? And is it, I mean, is it substantial, or how should we read it, I guess, is ultimately the question I'm asking.
Well, it's a sign that some of the protections and supports for unaccompanied minors were stripped out under Trump, and they can't be scaled up fast enough. So an emergency management system is being deployed. I hope that emergency management protocol includes child-sensitive and trauma-sensitive care, as opposed to just, you know, treating it sort of like a disaster, which it's not. This is pretty average in terms of migration flows. So I wouldn't read too much into it other than that the Biden administration is trying to provide a humanitarian response instead of a military response. And that's a huge shift and a positive one.
Sarah, we've talked before on this program about this, but for people who are just tuning in and maybe even tuning into this issue, given the change in circumstances, could you just talk a little bit, and this goes back to the introduction about the Immigration Law Clinic, but how this affects us here in this region, of how you see the effects, of how we see the effects. As you mentioned, we talk to immigrants every single day, but when it comes to these issues of how they impact us and impact us in this community.
I talk a lot with farmers who, for the last 4 years, have said that their workforce is terrified, who have been scrambling to provide employment security beyond pay and benefits and try to get people assistance to travel through this broken immigration system. I hear a lot from churches and faith-based groups who are frustrated that they have seen the vibrant migrant communities that they have lived and worked and played and worshiped with get locked up and tossed out of the country. In this region, I think we value and appreciate, most of us, there are, of course, some who don't, including Rensselaer County currently, which has the only 287G agreement in the entire state of New York that allows local law enforcement to cooperate with ICE. And there's a bill pending in the State House that would eliminate any local police cooperation with Immigration Customs Enforcement, which is a good move. But New York has a special relationship with immigrants because, you know, unless you're Native American, all New Yorkers have migrated from somewhere or have parents or grandparents who migrated from somewhere else to be here. So In this region, I hear a lot of care and concern to make sure that potential New Yorkers, as I like to call them, we have one of our clients who was stuck in the migrant protection protocol is resettled in a nice two-family home in Brooklyn and thriving, doing well, food on the table. And that's the New York that I see every day.
Libby?
You know, my son is a farmer, and when Sarah was talking about talking to farmers, it's been tough getting the help that they need to be able to do the, you know, to harvest and bring food to market, which impacts all of us. I mean, there's no two ways about it. It impacts all of us. If fields are left to fallow and food is left to rot, then we don't get to eat. And, you know, the small-mindedness of the Trump administration regarding this, and it was all about creating a white country for them. It had nothing to do with making sure people ate, that's for sure. You know, it has impacted the small farms. And even, I'm sure, some of the bigger farms. But my son's an organic farmer, and it has impacted his ability to get, you know, food to table. And it's got to stop. And what we see over in Rensselaer County has to stop as well. We have to stop thinking of immigration as illegal people, as these folks as illegal. I mean, I read the story this morning, and it was heartbreaking that there was a woman and her daughter that was stopped at the border, and she had to call her husband, who's already in Chicago, right? And that she couldn't cross over. You know, there needs to be some type of reunification in all of this. But I also think, and I go back to what Sarah was saying, is that the numbers aren't all that different. I think that the media, you know, the honeymoon period for the Biden administration didn't even last 100 days. And so they're looking for stuff to show that's negative. And I think that that's really unfortunate for the administration, but also for the media, in a sense that this is the focus. You know, after 4 years of Trump, and some of them being responsible for putting him in office, now it's about, you know, showing the shortcomings of the Biden administration, not giving this administration the chance that they need. Now, I know that the Biden administration is going to do their work regardless, and they're going to make a big difference, and this will get cleaned up, and other things will get cleaned up. But they're cleaning up 4 years of immigration mess that came on top of decades of immigration mess, but were not as mean and nasty and disgusting.
Jennifer, we have about 2 minutes.
I'm always struggling with which is the more powerful system at work here. Is it xenophobic or is it racist? And obviously they are intersecting and intertwining in this issue. But it's so difficult to also consider when immigrants are coming in that we frequently just associate them with farm working. And I know that historically that has been, you know, a role that they have filled. But it scares me because it sets up it perpetuates a continued stereotype. Because although that may be a foot in the door, that's not necessarily what immigrants who are coming to America want to do forever. And so when we're looking at, you know, by the COVID relief plan right now and how that's going to aid farmers, I think it's really important that we get immigration adjusted and really solidify that people coming in may need this to start, and our farmers in America need it. But also, we want immigrants who come into this country to be able to excel and bring all of their gifts and go beyond just being what we've stereotyped and pigeonholed them into, which is the kind of farm workers for other people. So I'm always struggling with this. And sometimes I wonder, you know, how do we keep track? And this is a Sarah question. The difference between a refugee and an immigrant, just someone who wants to move to America, but then also what is the criteria for allowing them in or expelling them? What can determine that? What rules?
Tons of them. Primarily, we're talking about the immigration code, a federal code. This is where we get into administrative law. They're implementing regulations in the code of federal regulations that are enforced by various executive branches, right? So the Department of Justice, the Department of Homeland Security, the Executive Office for Immigration Review, which is the judges, but those are also located in the Department of Justice, which is a quirk of immigration law that is messed up, but not the point of the question. When you're talking about refugees, you also have international human rights law. And there's a difference between a refugee and an asylee. A refugee has advanced permission to enter the country, and an asylee is someone who presents themselves at the border or the interior and expresses a credible fear of returning to their home country on account of political opinion, membership in a social group, ethnicity, religion, a number of different protected grounds. There are ways that people can be immediately expelled once they cross the border. That's where you hear people being, quote unquote, turned away. Sometimes that's a process done by Customs and Border Protection. Sometimes it's a process called expedited removal, where somebody gets removed without even seeing a judge. There are lots and lots of different ways that we have to keep people from coming in or to force them to leave once they've entered.
Sarah Rogerson on the Roundtable panel on Monday, March 15th. Please note as you listen, any given topics, details, and facts may have changed and evolved since the panels took place live earlier in the week. We'll be back with more Roundtable Panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. For Wednesday's Roundtable Panel, Alan Chartok and Joe Donahue welcomed investigative journalist and New Albany adjunct professor Rosemary Armeo, Times Union columnist Chris Churchill, and Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont.
Let's talk about Russian election influence this morning and the news from what we learned yesterday, that Putin targeted people close to Trump and bid to influence the 2020 election. That, according to U.S. intelligence, Russian President Vladimir Putin and other senior officials in Moscow sought to influence the 2020 election by spreading misinformation and misleading information about Joe Biden through prominent individuals, some of whom were close to former President Donald Trump. That, according to the intelligence community in a report yesterday. The report does not identify those individuals by name, but it appears to reference Trump's one-time personal lawyer, say it with me, Rudy Giuliani, whose repeated meetings with a suspected Russian agent came under scrutiny by U.S. officials. Both Russia and Iran sought to influence the election, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence said in its report, but a third major adversary, China, did not try, it says, contradicting the Trump administration's assertions about Beijing's activities last year.
The question I have for you, Joe, and everybody else on the panel is, if Trump had been reelected, right? If Trump had been reelected, would we ever seen this report?
Well, I mean, great point. I mean, we certainly knew.
I think we might have. Can I just?
Yeah.
Because Trump's own director of national intelligence came out and said publicly that there, you know, this is a couple of years ago, but he said that that there had been Russian interference in the 2016 election or attempts to interfere. And so I think, you know, Trump is so good at trying to discredit things that he probably, he just has discredited the intelligence community since even before he became president. And that certainly didn't stop while he was president, and it wouldn't have stopped if he had continued being president. So I don't think he would have been worried about this report being released. He just would have continued with the same kind of obfuscation that was one of his chief strategies.
Well, just to fight back on that a little bit, You know, I think that we really wouldn't know what would have happened. Obviously, you're right about that, and you're right that the national security agencies did raise voices about what was happening, even though Trump was in some obvious denial about the whole thing.
It's a good question about whether we would know this information if Trump had won. But, I mean, I think Trump would probably be highlighting and may even be highlighting the fact that Iran was apparently working to elect Biden or trying to help elect Biden. This information yesterday wasn't just about Vladimir Putin. It was also about Iran, although the China part of it is interesting for sure. Mm-hmm.
Maybe I read it wrong. I thought that the accusation was that Iran was working with Russia.
Iran's supreme leader, I'm going to mess up his name so I won't say it, approved a digital scheme to undercut Mr. Trump's reelection bid, the declassified report said. Which is not surprising. I mean, countries do this. We do this stuff all over the world, as Rosemary could probably tell you with her experience in, the Middle East and other places. This is, to a degree, what countries do. I think what we saw in 2016 might have been a little bit unprecedented, but, this is hardly a new idea.
Okay, so what I took away from this report is, yes, I'm really glad it's public. Two is that it does give a brand new look on China, different from the Trump administration. He kept trying to blame them. And there's very little evidence that China did anything. In fact, it's so eager to stabilize its relationship with the United States, they seem to have stayed out. And Iran was involved, but in a really kind of clumsy way. It was easily detected and not very effective. It is Russia. It has always been Russia that we ought to be concerned with, and that Trump never was. But what I really got out of this is, why is Rudy Giuliani not indicted? What happened to Lev and what happened to all of that? We knew a whole bunch of this. There's apparently further evidence that we didn't even know about, and yet there's no apparent ongoing investigation. I guess maybe they are, and it's all secret. But anyway, Lev and Rudy are still running around free and apparently in the clear. How has that happened? Are we really going to just try to move forward and forget about all this?
It's a great question. Lev Parnas and the like. Go ahead, Chris.
I just say, I think Russia's attempt this time was pretty clumsy, too. I mean, I think spreading information through Rudy Giuliani.
There you go.
Thank you. Is not exactly the
we'll edit that out. Don't worry.
Way to spread misinformation. It's worth noting too that the report also found that Cuba, Venezuela, and Hezbollah are also trying to influence the election in various ways.
Malia,
I think it is interesting that, as the report points out, China considered but decided not to try to interfere, and I think that's partly a result of the fact that the Biden administration's policy towards China in a lot of ways isn't actually that different in content from the Trump administration, because one of the few areas in policy where there is bipartisan consensus right now is that China is our major national security competitor. The Biden administration has already released its initial national security guidance. Defense Secretary Austin, Secretary of State Blinken are in Asia right now, their first trip they're taking jointly. Everyone in the foreign policy establishment knew that the Biden administration was not going to take a softer approach towards China than Trump did. Now, Trump was very mercurial in the way he interacted with Chinese officials, but I think Biden has sort of come out swinging. His first major foreign policy speech last month was about China. And as I said, the Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State are in Asia right now meeting with allies. And I think that's, China knew that, just like everyone in the American foreign policy establishment knew that was going to happen. So that's probably why they didn't see any real benefit in trying to interfere in the U.S. elections. I do want to make one other point that's related to this, given other tragic news today, which is that it's important for us to keep in mind, these are competitions between nations, right? Not between peoples. And the wave of violence and discrimination against Asian Americans in the United States needs to stop. And there's no reason to suspect the patriotism of anyone of Asian heritage or any immigrants from China. You know, there are, we have lots of students at Bard, for example, where I'm very proud to work, who are from China. And we're very glad to have these kind of people-to-people interactions and educational exchanges. And all that is incredibly important and needs to continue. This great power competition between the United States and China should not translate into bad relations between people.
You, of course, are talking about the 8 killed in shootings at spas in the Atlanta area, where 8 were killed and 6 of those were Asian women. A suspect was arrested. Chris, you were going to say.
I think Millie raised good points on all throughout that. Obviously, right, we're talking about nations, not types of people, and it is important to remember that. And she's absolutely right that the report actually says that China decided that neither administration was going to be favorable to it. So there wasn't much reason for it to try to influence the election. And beyond that, it was afraid of being caught and what that might mean. The risks really outweighed the rewards for China, which obviously Iran and Russia and some of the other countries didn't feel was the case.
Rosemary?
I what can I do except agree? I think that's what both Chris and Leah made points that I agree with. The hate crimes in this country is an ongoing, horrible blot on us. And I'm not sure what to do about it, although I am sure that the removal of Trump from office will help.
Let me go to, my goodness, I love this story from the New York Times about the incomplete wall. The pictures are just priceless. So, the whole thing is a tragedy, of course, but it's just insane looking at it. The Trump incomplete border wall is in pieces that could linger for decades, is the headline in the New York Times. A last-minute rush to build lasted through Trump's last day in office. The effort left odd, partially completed sections of a barrier whose fate President Biden must now determine. And if you get a chance to look at the pictures, they're just, again, it's a sad, sad story of how much money was spent on this, but it's just like a stretch of fence and then miles and then like this little chunk and then nothing. And now people are just going down to take pictures of it and to take a look. There it was, this unfinished piece of completely pointless wall right in this magical place, Julia Sheehan said, a nurse and former Air Force mechanic who tracked to the site with 3 other military veterans who are hiking the Arizona Trail. It's one of the most senseless things I have ever seen. It's just like this quarter-mile fragment of the wall, which is part of an array of new barrier segments around the border. Alan.
Yeah, we know that this was
I apologize. The one thing I just wanted to mention is So $15 billion is what we paid for what we have currently. Go ahead.
So that's what it was all about. It was all political. It was all that he wanted to make the point to keep those out. And he spent $15 billion to do it. It was crazy. We all knew it was nutty, loopy. But we did it. The country did it because he had the resources to make that happen. It was disgusting.
Rosemary.
I too was fascinated with this story, and I'm really eager to see what comes out of the review of the wall. He harmed the environment. He built these pieces of walls in places that were the most pristine and scenic and beautiful. He's increased the chance of erosion by digging out mountaintops and by actually increased the chance of smugglers and human trafficking by building roads in places where it had been inaccessible before. It's so damn mean-spirited what was going on right up until and on January 20th that it's just unspeakable to me. I want him to undo this. And I guess he has to make a decision, he and his Homeland Security and the Department of EPA maybe on what the cost would be to either just leave it as it is or to make fixes or to just reverse it. What a terrible chapter in American history. I can see this being tourism in the future where people will go to see Trump's folly wall. Crazy. Just a blot.
Chris?
So in my head, it kind of amuses me to juxtapose some of Trump's rhetoric, especially in the 2016 debates, you know, the Republican debates, where he would talk about how the wall was going to be huge and beautiful and Mexico was going to pay for it. And, you know, whenever somebody asked a tough question about the wall, he'd declare that it was going to be, it just got 10 feet taller or whatever he'd say, you know. And then to juxtapose that with this picture of this pathetic looking little fence that, like, anybody could just walk around, you know, in about 10 minutes. It's amusing. Although, as you said, Joe, when you talk about the money spent and some of the implications for it, it's really not that funny. But it really is a pathetic looking little thing. And it's also bizarre. Why did they? You would think that they would have a starting point
and an end point.
And an end point, but it's just in the middle of nowhere. There's just this little.
I can provide some insight into that.
Please do.
Yeah.
Because I actually, the picture, the story in the New York Times, Coronado National Memorials, actually, it's right down the road from Fort Huachuca, where I did a lot of my Army training. And I used to be a volunteer at Coronado National Memorial on the weekends. Yeah. And I did a couple things there. I would band hummingbirds, because it's a major migratory bird flyway, which is fascinating. And I would also pick up trash. There's a lot of trash from all the migrants who had come through, and where that section of wall is built is right where one of the major paths used to be. I have a picture of myself. The old fence used to be two strands of barbed wire. That was literally the U.S.-Mexico border, right where you see the picture in the New York Times. I have a photo of myself standing there. But the other ridiculous thing about this fence, besides the tragic fact, as Rosemary pointed out, that all the terrible environmental destruction. I mean, this is one of the most ecologically unique and diverse areas on the continent, that area of Arizona, the Sonoran Desert. But also, in order to build this fence, they had to disrupt or remove some of the other measures that they used to use, the border patrol used to use to see where migrants are coming across the border. There were underground sensors. Those are much more effective for tracking where people are coming across. And if your goal is to try to prevent people from crossing the border, using sensors to determine where they are is a much better measure or tool than putting a fence up. And so they had to dig up a lot of those sensors in order.
But I have a question for you. How did you get your hands on them?
The hummingbirds?
Yeah. Yeah.
I can tell you that it's the short story is it's basically you put a tent around a feeder and the size of the tent are raised and you sit 10 feet away hidden holding a string and when the hummingbirds come to the feeder you let go of the string and they're sort of inside the tent
and then
you reach in and you're able to safely grab them. There's a hummingbird monitoring network that I joined, and you could get literally clouds. Sometimes we would get 10 hummingbirds at a time.
Wow!
Do
they bite?
Really beautiful and fascinating. Do they
bite?
Do they do what?
Do they bite?
They don't bite. I never was harmed by a hummingbird, and I never harmed one either. I can say we would measure them and feed them, and then they would fly away.
I must say
little band around their leg.
Listening to you do this just makes me feel like the most insignificant human being on the planet. Good for you for saving our hummingbirds.
Like I feel like we wasted the last 2 hours. We should have been listening to hummingbird stories the whole time.
Absolutely.
That's why I'm brilliant. I heard it and I jumped on it. I said, that is really interesting.
My blood pressure just reduced just listening to all that.
It's a lovely story. Yeah, and we only have less than a minute. But then, what happens to them once you've monitored them and tagged them? Then they're off on their own again.
They're off on their own, and each tag has a number, and sometimes they get recaught. And, you know, these hummingbirds, they migrate from Alaska down to, you know, South America. They're amazing little creatures.
Malia Dumont on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, March 17th. We'll be back with more Roundtable panel the week in review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuc. On Thursday, March 18th, Joe and Alan spoke with Edward Hamilton, Distinguished Professor of Computer Science at RPI and Faculty Associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, Fran Berman, Professor of Sociology at UAlbany, Annie Chung, Senior Staff Attorney at the Immigration Law Clinic, Julina Guo, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI and Director of the RPI-IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration, Jim Hendler, Saratoga Springs-based Attorney, Ron Kim, and counterterrorism expert and best-selling author, Malcolm Nance.
So, you know the basic story probably by now of the horrific shootings that came out of the city of Atlanta. The man who police say went on a rampage at three spas in the Atlanta area has been charged with 8 counts of murder in connection with the attacks. They are now searching for a motive. The brazen shootings, which took the lives of 6 women of Asian descent, stirred considerable outrage and fear in the Asian American community. Investigators said they had not ruled out bias as a motivating factor, even as the suspect denied such racial animus once in custody. The suspect told police that he had a sexual addiction and had carried out the shootings at the massage parlors to eliminate his, quote, temptation. That according to authorities. He also said that he had frequented massage parlors in the past and launched the attacks as a form of vengeance. All but one of the victims were women, according to police. And the mayor of Atlanta said that regardless of the determination about motive, the tragedy was clear. So, Alan, I'll get your thoughts, and then we'll go to our special guests on this.
That's very kind of you, Joe. I say I pass because
okay.
Our special guests will be right up there.
Angie, let us go to you first on this of, you know, we're already getting mail from our listeners of saying if this has not been determined to be a hate crime, then why are we making that assumption? I hope that you can answer, or, you know, at least address that, but also to the larger issue that I know is something you have been dealing with on the campus, on your campus, is that there has been this concern and fear among the Asian American community for quite some time.
Right. Well, thank you for that question. I'm not a criminologist, so I'm not going to say, and I don't know the details of the case other than what's been published in the media. But I think what's important to think about is the larger context of what's been going on the past year. As you noted, I actually don't live in Albany, but I work there, and I've been doing a lot of interviews with students on campus. And it's clear, even in this town, that despite the fact that no one is actually outside because of the quarantine, they've been subject to all types of microaggressions, verbal attacks, and even some instances of physical attacks as well. And it also, if you study the history of Asian Americans in the United States, this is really not a surprise. And particularly if you look at a lot of the commentary that has been used by the previous president, and very antagonistic, kind of insinuating that Asian Americans are to blame for what's been going on, it's something that we really need to turn our attention to. And I also think it's important to point out that the victims are Asian American women. We've also, if you look at the, I don't know if you mentioned the Stop AAPI Hate website, but they've documented all kinds of instances of crimes against Asian Americans across the U.S., particularly against elderly, which is very, it's quite outrageous. So this is a pattern. This is something that we need to turn our attention to and think about seriously.
Ron Kim, let me bring you in into the conversation. In the city of which you were considering running for mayor, you are feeling this. You see this within the community.
Well, I do think that there's bias in this instance of this slaughter of innocent people. There was bias when this person went into those businesses. He exhibited his sort of white supremacy bias when he went there, and then when he decided the only solution to his personal problem was to kill these people. So, you know, I'm a little bit amazed that we've sort of accepted this conclusion that, well, it wasn't, he just had a psychological problem of sex addiction. It's so very clear to me that it was both a bias crime against race and female, a sex crime. So it's very sort of disturbing to see the dialogue now on TV and the press that, in fact, well, it really wasn't. He just had a bad day.
That was the statement from one of the police officers who spoke yesterday, of saying that in his talking to him, that he said that the guy just had a really bad day. That police officer also, quite unfortunately, has a history of posting anti-Asian American content and even selling T-shirts about the China flu on his website. So for what that is
so interesting.
Malcolm, let's go to you on this. So what is the difference between a young man who is, quote unquote, ridding himself of his temptation and domestic terrorism?
Well, the thing that designates a person a domestic terrorist, and I've said it on this program many times, I hate the word domestic when used with regards to acts of terrorism. I prefer to use the technical term we use in the intelligence community, American terrorist.
Yeah.
Because if you're carrying out an act of terrorism, we don't particularly care where you're from. We just use that as a designator. So if you're an American who's in Somalia or an American who's in northern Syria and you work for a terrorist group or carry out a terrorist act, we're going to designate you that way. Domestic is this little twist that I think we use here to soften the blow that we have a country chock full of terrorists. And in this particular instance, we're going to find out whether the true basis of this attack. So right now, you see people are using the term hate crime because that places it within a legal framework. But the way, but since we have a country that's chock full of mass murders, spree killers and serial killers, it's a little difficult until we find out what is the base purpose of his ideology. Was this personal? Was he out to kill these individuals because he had a relationship with one, or he just, as he says, and I never believe a terrorist, right? You never believe a criminal at their confession because there's something in it for them. Or it's a way to exculpate what there really is. And a good example of that was the Pulse massacre, where the guy claimed that he was a member of ISIS, but it turned out, in fact, that he was ashamed of his gayness, that he was actually there, had boyfriends. So you can never listen to them. So in the final term here, what this guy has done, all right, clearly had a racial focus on it. And you can't say, well, I felt shame of sex, I have a sex addiction, so I went to massage parlors that he may have frequented and just started killing them. I mean, why didn't he go to the first adult bookstore that he drove by? Why didn't he go, why wasn't he a serial killer of prostitutes on the street? This is personal. And despite, what they said yesterday at the press conference, where they were laying out facts, And we do have a little problem with the spokesman for the police department there, who himself had been distributing racist material and advocating it on the web. But it just goes to show that when it's what I'm now starting to refer to as a rat, right? A radicalized Anglo terrorist, these people tend to be treated with kids' gloves. I'm hardly going to be surprised if we find out that they took him out for chicken McNuggets after the massacre, after his arrest, right? We have a tendency that if they're white, that it's rationalized instantly and put into a box where everyone could understand where he came from. And that's not how law enforcement should work, and it is definitely not how crimes against, racial crimes should be managed. Because what it does is it frames this as something other than what it probably really is.
Angie, any thoughts on what Malcolm just said?
Right. I mean, I completely agree. I think there's two aspects here. First is the defense he's trying to prop up, but certainly it's also his enablers that, I think that the race of not only the victims, but also the perpetrator is very relevant here. How would this have been portrayed if the perpetrator was non-white or black, right? I totally agree with also what Ron said earlier, that this is really, if you look at the details of the case and you think about how Asian American women have been portrayed historically, this just goes along with, the continuity of everything that's been going on the past 4 years. And I think that, the intent and, all these things need to be really analyzed critically and deeply within that context.
We just got a letter from a listener, and I'm just going to read it, I'd like you all to respond to this. It's from Steve, and he says, your panel is viewing these shootings through a racial lens because that is how your panel views absolutely everything. There is nothing that is not about race for the progressive left. It is the lens through which everything is viewed no matter what. Tell me I'm wrong. Who would like to tell Steve he's wrong?
I'm not telling him he's wrong.
I sort of thought this would be the case. So let me do round robin here. Fran?
It's pretty clear that the person who did this is a crazy person. And it's an incredibly tragic thing. And it needs to, whether it's a hate crime or not, it needs to be prosecuted in a reasonable way and to the extent of the law. But what it brings up, whether this was a hate crime or not, is there's an incredible uptick in hate crimes. And I do think that the Asian American community in this country is not getting the focus that these hate crimes require. And I just want to share a personal story. So Jim and I at RPI have been teaching this year, and we've been teaching online. And I will tell you from my own experiences with both Asian students and Asian American students, they have had a really crappy time of it. I've had students that shared with me that they were walking down the street, that people, stop a car, yelled at them, told them the virus was their fault, that they have felt isolated, that they have felt within their community, that the highest leader of the United States in the last administration, that Trump was telling them the virus was their fault. And, these things are just not okay. And, so whether this tragedy, true tragedy in Georgia was a hate crime or not, and I know we're going to get to the bottom of it, and I'm really delighted that our guests are here to provide their perspective on it. But whether this tragedy was a hate crime or not, hate crimes are happening. There's 150% uptick in hate crimes against Asian Americans. And we need to give that the attention it deserves. And we need to do something about it.
Malcolm?
This is what gets me when we're talking about race. And now I'm going to step back and I'm going to start talking about this and how I view this from a global terrorism perspective. We have a saying in my business, right? The terrorist determines the target, right? And what that means is when a terrorist attacks, and I'm going to use this in the context of terrorism, when a terrorist attacks, he doesn't just select things randomly, right? They go out and they have a focus on what they're trying to do. So if you're in Afghanistan and you're ISIS of Khorasan, which is their ISIS variant and that fights against both the Taliban and the United States, right? There's a reason that you go after U.S. troops. If you're going against the Taliban, there's a reason for that, too. So in this particular instance, I have to analyze the target. I have to look at what the target set was. And this, and now I have three massage parlors or spa, day spas, right, that do massages outside of Georgia, geographically disparate locations. They weren't close to each other, right? But they were associated with the operative who carried out the attack. So they meant something to him. Another component of why they meant something to him was they also happened to have a particular group of people or of a certain ethnicity that operated these facilities, right? So I cannot remove race from the factor that this person targeted these facilities because they were Asian. Again, if it was about sex addiction, there's 1,000 different places you can go to for that. I mean, shoot your computer first thing in the morning.
Right.
I mean, this was personal to him. And if it was a matter of religion, you know, I mean, you got to remember something. This guy purchased the firearm the day before with the intent to go to these locations to do whatever they were. He shot 6 out of 8 people were Asian. And we don't know if the other 2 people were customers. But he wanted to eliminate these places. And I find it very hard to believe that he wanted to eliminate them for God, right? Even though that may have been a motivating factor. You know, it was personal to him. So, you know, race domination of women, of Asian women in the United States is a thing. And if you eliminate that, then what you're doing is you're telling me you cannot factor race into anything because you come from a position of privilege. It's as simple as that. This is how we analyze all intelligence in the world, people. But if the moment you tell me take that factor out, then you've corrupted any real assessment I could come up with.
Angie, let me ask you this question. We have gotten several letters, one from Linda, one from Allison, one from Trish, and many others. But those are the ones that I'm looking at here that say, why isn't the shooting a hate crime against women since all the victims were women? And if the man is saying that he had to kill the temptation, meaning women, we're still punishing women instead of demanding men control themselves. What do you make of that into this conversation?
Well, I think it's problematic to necessarily separate women from, you know, racial stereotypes. I think if you look at the way Asian American women have been portrayed, like I said, historically, it's very specific. This image of Asian American women being very passive, having being very exotic, and also certainly the eroticism that's been associated with that stereotype makes the kind of images that come up and why they are the subject of these attacks very specific to both their racial identity as well as their gender. You know, and it's not to deny, certainly domestic violence against women is also a crucial issue. But that, I think I see this as overlapping circles, right? That when you put into it the factor that these women, you know, even if you look at some of the media representations, the fact that these women worked at massage parlors, you know, already all types of images specific to Asian American women have been conjured up. And I think that's very important to focus on. One other thing I want to say about the previous comment, if I might, you know, we've spent so much time since the 1960s not talking about racism, right? Why do we talk about racism now? Because we've spent so many decades denying that it continues to exist, despite the fact that racial segregation laws and miscegenation laws have been eliminated. You know, these are things that we've hidden and we've denied exist. And, you know, that's partly why this discourse is just exploding for all types of racial minority groups across the U.S. So I just wanted to add that comment from the previous question.
Angie Chung on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, March 18th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable or via podcast. You may contact us by emailing roundtable@wamc.org. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.
Politics screws everything up.